To the latest very special episode of the Serious TV Drama Podcast. I'm Scott, and joining me this week, the man dueling with Jamie for the permanent substitute co-host slot here at STVD Productions, it's Brian. Hey, Brian.
Hey, Scott. This is about my 15th callback for an audition, so I feel like it's going well so far.
Don't worry. You're my Alex Cora there over there. So, we are here not to discuss Fargo, because, hey, it isn't nearing midnight on Sunday night. Nope, we are here to discuss number 17 on the countdown of the greatest TV drama episodes of all time. And this week, it's an episode of Mr. Robot. Specifically, it's 407 Proxy Authentication Required, which was the seventh of the Mr. Robot's fourth and final season. Now, I'll let you guys know right now, this, at least so far in the countdown, this is probably the most contentious of the picks, you know, for these first four slots. And I don't mean the series. I mean, any fan of Mr. Robot knows that there are a number of other episodes that could have possibly be considered the quote-unquote best episode of the series. You know, rest assured, we'll probably talk about a little bit about that towards the end of the podcast. But first, as I've been doing, let me get a little disclaimer out of the way, which actually applies to this selection as well. It applies to every selection. It's how the episodes were chosen for the countdown, just to make it clear that this isn't just me creating a list, though I am inclined to do such things. I pulled together several articles that had been published over the years that I was able to find online, of course. You know, everything from Entertainment Weekly to things out of the UK, as well as different lists that people had put out. And I don't mean bloggers, I mean actual real publications. Some of them are also based in the UK because they love doing lists out there. Put all that information together to find which were the episodes of TV shows that were most cited. Sometimes there were a few. You know, you start coming down to picking which one had the higher ranking overall. And that is generally how the list came about. The only thing that could be some point of contention with for myself is, you know, the order could be up for debate, so to speak. You know, should number 15 actually be number 13 and stuff like that? Who cares? It's basically the top 20. And if you don't like it, you know, there's other podcasts you can listen to. I love just insulting the few listeners we have from the get-go.
Hey, it's your brand, man. Stick with it.
Yeah, it's worked so well so far. So now that that's over with, let me get to a little teensy bit of history about this series we're going to be talking about, Mr. Robot. Now, as many of you will probably recall, it ran from 2015 to 2019. It racked up about 45 episodes. The creator was Sam Esmail, who also wrote, he specifically wrote at least 24 of the 45 episodes. I'm sure he had a hand in writing a number of others. And he directed a few episodes in season one, and then he directed all the episodes for the next three seasons. It's a series that really marked a very bold and different approach for the USA Network. That was a network that was one of the more popular basic cable networks, if not the most popular, as far as original program is concerned. They had already had, over the years, a number of solid, crowd-pleasing series. You know, your shows like Monk and Psych, Suits, and Burn Notice. Mr. Robot was a major change. It was far different. You know, it's not inappropriate to refer to it even as groundbreaking, because it was quite cinematic. And at that time, it was really fell into the "we've never seen anything quite like this on TV" kind of a game changer. The way people would talk about shows like, you know, like Twin Peaks in the 90s or the Sopranos at the very end of the 90s going into the aughts, whatever. I think Mr. Robot, maybe it doesn't get thought of in that upper echelon, but I think it can stake a claim for being just as landmark a series on television as those two, among others. There are others, but you know, we don't have all day to list a bunch of TV shows. Okay, so as we all know, because you know, everyone who's listening, you've watched the show before, and you've watched this specific episode. Mr. Robot revolves around Elliot Alderson, a cybersecurity engineer who turns out to be a hacker who's far more comfortable around codes and keyboards and people. And just as he suffers not just from merely social anxiety, he's clearly clinically depressed, and we soon learn he's got a serious case of dissociative identity disorder. Hell, you could probably throw a few other mental illnesses or disorders which have taken root in Elliot over the years. Not to mention, when we first meet him, he's got himself a little bit of a drug addiction as well, morphine of all things, which may help him tamp down his anxieties, but it also likely further numbs him that much more to the people in the world around him. Now, the setup of the show from the get-go, you know, the beginnings of season one, you know, we're introduced to him, and he's recruited to be a major player in this group of hacktivists who are also, they're looking to bring down this all-powerful and naturally evil E-Corp, which from that point on is referred to as Evil Corp. Now, I'm fairly sure, forget the fairly, I'm sure, a lot of this, when the show started, was inspired by the Occupy Wall Street protests and movement that had been really raging on just a few years earlier. Lord knows I live here in New York City and couldn't get away from it here. The big catch is that he appears to have been recruited by their leader, who's not just a stone-cold cynic, but a total anarchist as well, and he goes by the name Mr. Robot. And, of course, we all eventually learn that Mr. Robot is not... I think we all figure out pretty soon no one else can see Mr. Robot, and that then we realize he's not just a figment of Elliot's imagination. It's actually another identity that he adopts at times. He's not just his fictional character, his addled brain is cooked up. He actually resembles, he's the personification of his dead father. We also learn a lot more about Mr. Robot, who and what Mr. Robot really is over time. But the shorthanded, he's both a construct of Elliot's mind that may be the image of his father, but he's more like his protector, you know, the father Elliot wanted instead of what he actually had. Thus, that's the identity Elliot takes on to be more assertive, to be in charge, to even, it's undoubtedly helped him interact and be in charge of others, you know, as he is with F Society at the beginning of the series. There's any number of other secrets that get revealed along the way. Most of them relate to Elliot's childhood, you know, such as the fact that we didn't know until late in the first season that Darlene is actually his sister, you know, a revelation along with the one about Mr. Robot being his dad, you know, which are all featured in one, you know, in one or two great episodes that were actually a contender for this slot. But by the time we get to the fourth season, where are we with the series? You know, with season four, it's all out war with White Rose and the Dark Army. Angela's killed off at the start of the season, and it's really just Elliot and Darlene at this point. You know, FBI Dominique is living a miserable life as a mole and puppet for the Dark Army. And there's always several balls being kept in the air all at once, such as all the aforementioned, the continuing intrigue at E-Corp with Price, Tyrell showing up once again, as well as the increasingly tenuous grip Elliot has on reality due to his double identity as Mr. Robot. And on top of all this, the drug dealing and Shayla murdering gangster Vera has resurfaced, who, much like the Dark Army, he's looking for Elliot. And he's also looking to unlock the secrets behind him in order to control him. And that is all that leads us up to the episode we'll be talking about tonight, 407 Proxy Authentication Required. Now, that's a whole lot of talking for me.
Well, I will just add to my thoughts on this, the show up until this point. If you go back and watch, and I've watched some episodes you have as well, this was really a remarkable show in that the characters pose massive redistribution of wealth. It's not the type of thing that a traditional television network would probably put on. It's very dark, very edgy. But it was really enjoyable. The first season was gangbusters. The second season was uneven. The third season was fantastic, and they really went balls to the wall in the fourth season. And then and for the reasons we'll discuss soon, you and I both sort of agree that for our pick for this show, this is the episode that knocked our socks off.
Oh, God, absolutely. And your assessment of the season is pretty much spot on. Bit of a sophomore slump for the show, but kind of gathered itself back up in season 3 and took off from there. And then season 4, I would say they stuck the landing, at least in our opinion. So, but we'll talk, we'll probably talk a little bit about other episodes from this season and that is, you know, a little bit later, but let's dive into Proxy Authentication Required here. The episode was, of course, written and directed by Sam Esmail. Actually, there were two other staff writers who also worked on the episode, but Esmail does really take the full credit. Because, you know, if you dig into the details of the episode, you'll discover this episode was nominated by the Writers Guild of America for episodic drama, but only one person was nominated, Sam Esmail, not these two other staff guys. So I'm not even saying what their names are. I'm a writer. You think I'd want to give them more credit? Anyway, let's get into this episode. Now, there's something with Mr. Robot that's interesting, is that every once in a while, Sam Esmail likes to do something. He likes to just experiment, you know, just kind of do something kind of bold, kind of different. You know, sometimes it works brilliantly. Sometimes it's decent, but not great. You know, there's episodes even from this season. There's one we'll talk about a little bit later that involves practically no dialogue, which was kind of a landmark thing. He had another episode, which from I think a previous season, where it was modeled after like an early, not even late 80s, more like an early 90s sitcom, you know, like the stuff that would be the part of the TGIF kind of lineup or something. That one, it's an okay episode. I don't particularly love it. And I think you could say the same thing, and there's other examples of that as well, the episode where it's all one shot kind of a thing. You know, he just does that from time to time. This was also kind of an experiment in a way. It's probably his most successful of all of them. And there's a couple really brilliant ones, but this one I think just takes the cake. This one, as we all have seen now, it pretty much takes on the structure of a stage play. I mean, it's everything from the way it's directed. It's actually broken up specifically into acts where we actually get, you know, act one, act two, act three on screen, whatever. The way the action is blocked out on screen and the way the set is used, because, you know, not including the credits where we're riding along with Elliot in the back, in the trunk of a car in the dark, the entire episode takes place within the psychiatrist's apartment, Krista's apartment. So it not only does it have a stage play feel, whatever, you could say this would technically qualify as a bottle episode too, quite frankly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's one of those episodes that I think left any fan kind of just with their jaws kind of like on the floor, you know, at a certain point, and just by the end of it, and you couldn't take your eyes off it. When this originally ran on television, is what I should mention as well, it ran with no commercials. So if you saw it when it originally aired on the USA Network, you didn't get a break unless you chose to pause your DVR TV thing and go to the bathroom or something. You were kind of locked in for the entire hour with this episode. Which works really well because at a certain point there is kind of an unrelenting feel to it, I would say.
Yeah, and I went and did some research on this. Strangely enough, this episode aired almost a year to the day we're doing the podcast ago. It aired on my birthday last year, which is the 17th of November. And when I looked that up, I thought, wow, like that. I know I watched it that day because at this point of the season, I was following all the episodes really into the show. And I think you and I probably agree that this episode is remarkable for a number of reasons. But if you look at what is divulged in this episode, in addition to the fact that he made such a bold choice on how to present that information, this was really something that in the end he pulled off and really shook the foundation of the show by the time it was over.
Right. It's something, a revelation, which even though we all know what it is, I'm still not going to, we're going to start talking about it in a moment, but you know, we're almost there. But just following what you're saying, to do something which could potentially and clearly shake up a show to that extreme an extent this late in the run. I mean, you do that, you know, during the first season, and it's like, oh, that's a different show, but you know, then we'll see what they do from this point on. You know, much just like if you were killing off a major character at some point in the first season, which we've talked about in the past as well. This is bigger, I would say.
I totally agree.
And what's interesting about that, and I can't, it's funny, I did not put this in my notes, but it's something I just know to say, and I can't believe I didn't, but maybe it's because it's so obvious. One of the most interesting things about Mr. Robot, and we see it more the, you know, the further we go into the series, although if we hadn't caught on by late season one, then, you know, we're idiots. It's the rare television series that we are watching the show with an unreliable narrator. Elliot is literally narrating parts of this to us. We're his imaginary friend, which was always one of the really nice, brilliant conceits of the show. So, you know, I can't imagine how much voiceover studio work he had to do, you know, over and over again for the show. But the fact is, as we discover throughout the series, there are things he doesn't know and doesn't remember. And then you don't know either, is it deliberate? Has he just, you know, blacked out certain parts of his life, certain things, whatever, so on and so forth. So you don't quite know if you should believe what you're seeing or what it is you're seeing. You know, are certain things figments of his imagination and constructs or not? You know, and they play with that every once in a while. They do things to, whether they're having fun with us or not. It gets a little confusing. There's something that's actually confusing that happens in a subsequent episode that I want to bring up, but I don't want to talk about a later episode when we have finished talking about this one. I'll give you
a hint. Let me add to what you're saying.
Go ahead, please.
Something that I love about this show, and this episode encapsulates that, is a lot of shows run with other characters and show us things the main character doesn't know that relates directly to them. This show, for the most part, almost universally, we always have the same information Elliot has. Mm-hmm. And what he doesn't know, most of the time we don't know either. And in this episode, when he discovers something, we discover it with him. And it's a...
Well, yeah. I sort of agree with you. I differ slightly, but when I get to that part, you'll understand what I'm saying. Otherwise, 99% of the time, absolutely, you're absolutely right on that. This episode, I think there's a slight difference. But we'll get there, because I want to build to that. So I just want to take care of some of the housekeeping of this episode before we get there.
Sure.
Another thing I was noticing watching this again, unlike almost practically most other Mr. Robot episodes, in my mind, there are a couple other exceptions I can think of right now, I think. Beyond the moment where he shows Vera and his men the amount of money that Elliot will soon have access to from the Deus group, this is an episode that tech and other computer coding and hacking wizardry that, you know, seems to dominate a lot of episodes, plays no part in this episode. It's not about that at all. This is truly a character backstory revelation emotional connection episode and nothing else outside of that. Digging into the episode further, came across something that was interesting. I was looking at different Reddit pages, which I don't do that often. And people always ask me, you know, whatever show I'm talking about at the time. This goes back to the Breaking Bad era, right up through Game of Thrones and Fargo and whatever else. I have certain friends like, oh, did you read blah, blah, blah on Reddit? And it's like, I don't look at Reddit. You know, I know what it is. You know, it's fascinating, but I just don't. But I did look at it for this because I'd heard about something from someone else, and I came across this idea that they compared the five-act structure of this episode to the five stages of grief. And I sat there thinking about that as I read that, because, and this is going to be my apologies to everybody, but, you know, Scott has to be, you know, self-centered and whatever. There is a script I wrote that it turned, one of the things we realized in later drafts, and it's one of the two I'm most proud of, whatever, and it was supposed to have been made already, by the way. I realized it's like, you know what I did, and I didn't, and I totally didn't mean to do it. And I was like, what? It's like, if you break down the story, I take the character through five stages of grief, and I swear to God, I don't think I consciously did that, but it's all there. It's just the way I thought about it, and that's the way it played out. And they were, and both producers were like, yeah, you did do that. You really didn't intend that. And like, no, it's a happy accident. I can't believe it. That might be the case here, because one of the stages, I think they're a little iffy on here, but the way they broke it out, they had like, you know, act one is about, you know, is denial. That's like what Elliot calling Vera stupid and denying his goal. You know, act two, anger, Mr. Robot being Mr. Robot, of course. You know, act three, it's bargaining, begging Vera not to kill Chris, to try to make the deal with him. Act four, depression, when we learn, we'll just say, the truth. Act right. Five is the one I'm a little iffy on, because they say act five, Elliot's coming to terms with Vera. Although part of me was like, does that really happen? Unless you really think they had that brief connection in that final moment before Vera is, you know, stabbed in the back. You know, it's a little bit of a push. But otherwise, I said, you know, I'll go along with that. I having watched a number of episodes, I feel that Esmail does tend to pack his writing, not just with, good Lord, a million homages and nods to any number of movies and TV series over the years and stuff like that. And you could go Easter egg crazy on this show, quite frankly. You know, like, just keep your eyes open for even things that are on billboards and signs, whatever, and when they recur in other episodes or and so on and so forth. Whether he had that in mind as well, totally possible. I don't know. Now, I don't want to leave it out there. Let me get to what you were just talking about. And you were talking about the idea that one of the interesting things about Mr. Robot is, like, we learn things when he learns things, right?
Right.
And I would say generally that's true. And I say why I don't say that about this episode. Except for the perhaps the more, and I don't mean to disparage anyone who watches Mr. Robot, but let me put it this way. The brilliance of this reveal, now, you know, we start, I would think many, if not most, we start to suspect what's going on during Krista's questions with Elliot. And there's a certain point, I think we all know what's coming. Because he doesn't know it yet, but we know it. So, and the reason why that works and why I believe that to be what happens, we deal with the shock of what the news is before he says it, before he realizes it. So we get to experience that shock ourselves. That way, when we get to his realization, we're not reacting to the news as much as we're reacting to how he's taking the news. It gives us a more pure way of looking at Elliot and the performance itself, quite frankly, you know, and to feel the emotion of the moment that much more, because we know we're cringing, because it's like that there's only one thing it can be at this point. It's become pretty clear between the things that Mr. Robot is saying in the room while all this is going on, and where the questioning is going, and it's one of those things be interesting to, like, ask any number of people who watch the episode. It's like, at what point during that, those questions and answers, or whatever you want to call it, the forced therapy session, did you realize what was happening? And there, you know, some people might have caught on to it really quickly. Some people might have taken a little bit longer. But I think everybody knew it before it was said. And at least, you know, at least a minute or two before it happened. I'd be very surprised if anyone says, oh, I didn't know it until they actually said it. Maybe they did. I don't think that's, because I think they deliberately did it in such a way where it's like, because once we get there, because we get there before Elliot, then we're kind of like Mr. Robot's like, no, because this is going to devastate him. This is
right.
This is going to kill him. I think that's what makes that scene work so well.
I agree with that, and I guess semantically though, what
yeah, you're right. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to.
the reveal of it as it's being revealed to him. What we've suspected becomes confirmed. We know something happened with the window. They planted these signals. And I will say, one of the beauties of this series, and you and I talked offline yesterday, or maybe the day before, but if you go back and watch early episodes of this show, there was a plan. And you see that I'm sure there were extraneous story and B stories and stuff that worked out along the way, but there was a plan in place for this show that was leading to this moment.
Oh, absolutely. We talked about it a bit after we recorded the Fargo podcast. I was maintaining, or I think it's clear, they were hinting at this truth since the very beginning. You know, I think I was talking to you about it. It's like, you know, the very first time we meet Elliot in the pilot of the series, what we see him doing is he's hacked and exposed someone who's been running a child porn site. So that is the first thing we see him fighting against, so to speak. Not some white collar money, you know, whatever you want to call it. And also we see right from the get go, he does not like being touched. But also, it's not just that he doesn't like being touched. One will notice or note he reacts far more stronger when it's a male, because we do see him at times embracing both Angela and Darlene in the series. But when a guy reaches up to put his hand on his shoulder or touches him, he freaks out far more.
Right.
It's just as far as reveals and whatever. And the performance that was involved with I think we'll talk a little bit about all the performances in this episode, but Rami Malek in that scene, those handful of minutes when he's either before he realizes and when he does realize and then after, I'm saying right now, that was better than anything he did in Bohemian Rhapsody. And he won the Oscar for that.
Right.
So the fact that this, and I probably wrote this way further in my notes, who cares, I'll say it now. The fact that this episode didn't get any Emmy nods for anything, I can't believe I was railing about how, like, Odenkirk and Seahorn should have been nominated for Better Call Saul, and of course they should have, absolutely. But this episode didn't get a writing nod or a directing nod. You know, the guy who plays Vera didn't get a supporting guest actor or supporting actor nod. That's ridiculous. I'm sorry.
I actually read somewhere online someone who said his deterioration throughout this, you know, forced therapy session was one of the best. And this was somebody who'd been a victim, said that was one of the best portrayals they'd seen of somebody facing something they'd blocked or someone suffering PTSD.
Right.
There are things you see that you go, wow, that's great acting. And academically, you look at it and objectively and say, wow, that was really amazing. And then there are things that just hit you in your bones. And this just viscerally hits you in a way that it was so powerful and so well done. And what I think is amazing, if at the beginning of a show, you were going to sit down and pitch a show, and say, now listen, ultimately the character whose name is the name of the show is going to be an incestuous molester of the main character. They would throw you out on your ear.
Yeah.
And that's what's so wild about where this episode takes us is that Mr. Robot, who ultimately, you know, is a creation, but represents a man that did this to his kid. That's what's so mind-blowing about what we learn, how we learn it, how it's staged. And let me just say, as the episode progresses, it's also very reminiscent of a play that they use lightning and thunder the way stage productions often do to announce, you know, rage or emotion. Mm-hmm. And that's used very effectively throughout the episode as well.
Oh, yeah. I love the touch. And it did make me think of, like, watching... for some reason, when I think of thunder and lightning in plays, I usually think of, like, a Shakespearean play. And I remember, right. I remember doing some stage work way, way, way when I was a wee, wee bitty child, whatever, and having to, like, you shake this piece of metal to make the thunder sound and stuff like that, and the flashing lights for the lightning was kind of fun. Good times. They were a bit more sophisticated in this episode, thankfully. And speaking of things, you know, little added touches that really gave an intense ambiance and tone and feeling to the episode, we would be remiss if we also, and there's more to talk about in the episode itself, of course, but let's just get this out of the way right now, too. The music, the score. It was done by Mac Quayle, did it. It's, again, Esmail is a student of film. You can see the work of anyone, you know, a number of different acclaimed directors has influenced what he's been trying to do. You know, there's a certain Kubrickness to a lot of stuff he does, and so on and so forth. The score, in my opinion, it absolutely echoes what I always like to refer to as the beautifully bombastic work of my second favorite movie score composer of all time, Bernard Herrmann. So when you hear the score and how it's used in this episode, and at times it does seem to be over the top, and it's obviously that's also deliberate. Think of Hitchcock movies like Vertigo. Think of the original, or actually they used it again for the remake as well. Think Cape Fear. Think those kind of movie scores, and that's kind of what they're doing here. It's got that big, lush, but driving, powerful. It's very unusual for this show. I mean, this show obviously does a lot of interesting things with their both musical composition-wise as well as songs they choose in different episodes. This, again, was another departure for the show. And, again, I just thought it just helped raise... It was just one more thing that raised the pedigree of this episode to, like, the upper strata as far as I was concerned.
Absolutely. And I think if we were making, you know, our list of things that separate it for us, I mean, some of the amazing things you've already touched on is, and I hadn't even thought of it when you said it, but the absolute lack of technology in a show that centers around technology,
right?
In an episode that mainly relies on practical effects to, you know, to present its story and uses sort of old school music. That's amazing, vibrant, lush, and the photography is wonderful. I think in particular the scene where the camera goes over the top of the wall from one room to the other.
Right.
A masterful episode and the reason we're talking about it.
Right. It's also going along with what really differentiates it from most any other episode of Mr. Robot, if not television in general. You know, I think it's interesting that, you know, again, despite this being a show that is often built on the complicated machinations of conspiracies and very involved schemes and hacking and, you know, multiple factions of Evil Corp and the Dark Army and the FBI, I love the idea that what I would say is the truly best episode, it's boiled down to this stark stage play that really just focuses on three people. Because you can kind of forget about Peanuts and Javi. You know, they don't even reappear in this episode. After this episode, you know, kind of underscores that they're not really important. Although you do get a couple of nice moments, you know, especially the one between Mr. Robot and Peanuts, which is especially cool. You know, Nickelodeon over there. But, you know, it's really about those three. And again, while we're raving about, it's obvious to go right and rave about Rami Malek. Equal love got to be given to Gloria Rubin as Krista, because she had been on any number of episodes before this, and she was always damn good. But here, you know, wow. It's unfortunate that she's forced in a part where she's, you know, kind of the up until the end helpless victim situation. But the fact that what she does at the end kind of, I think, absolves the script of that. But Elliot Villar is as Vera, and he had always been a really solid performer on the show in his previous appearances. But holy crap. He was toe to toe with Rami through a lot of this episode. He obviously didn't have a scene like Malek has with the revelation or whatnot, but he's damn good in this episode otherwise.
He is. And the thing I liked when I rewatched it is all of the powerful people that have went up against Elliot, none of them figured out how to get to him. Mm-hmm. And this guy, who is the non-tech drug dealer guy, figured it out. And we find that he saw something in Elliot he recognized in himself, also being a victim of abuse. And that the one person who broke through Elliot's armor was this guy, was a nice touch too. That, you know, with as powerful as White Rose and Philip Price and Wallach have been throughout this series, and their resources and means and research, none of them could break Elliot, but he broke him.
Right. I mean, and one could even say, to a certain degree, they kind of called their shot with this character again, going back to season one. I mean, it was his murder of Shayla in that really one of those really great episodes of the series, which kind of left Elliot kind of shaken, and it was his first experience up to that extreme. But you know, the whole Prison Break episode, Brave Traveler, which is definitely would be on the short list of possible contenders for best episode of the series.
That's my number two.
I'm not sure what, I don't know if I have an order in my head for that. Plus then what's great is, because going back to that episode, then you have the poetic justice in this episode that the knife that actually killed Shayla back in season one is the knife that kills Vera here. So,
right.
Which in a weird way, his brother got what he wanted after all, even though I always think, oh, not only does his brother die, he ended up going and playing Wild Dog on The Flash for a few, Green Arrow, excuse me, for a few years. Really, that's the same actor. Actually, digging into, it's funny, mentioning The Flash, for some reason I had it in my head that Gloria Rubin used to be on a soap opera. I realized at a certain point I was confusing her with another actress when I started looking into her IMDb page and whatnot, and I couldn't find anything. And then I think I know who it was I confused her with. But what I didn't know, they're probably on YouTube or something, or IMDb, one of those weird services. She actually appeared on several episodes of the original Flash TV show from 1990. And it just says her character's name is Sabrina. I was like, I have no idea who that was. I can't remember. I haven't seen it in 30 years. I don't know. She might have been one dude's girlfriend or someone who worked at the police station. I don't know. But I was like, wow. And then I start thinking, oh my God, how old is Gloria Rubin? She looks great.
She's living right, man. Looking good.
Yeah, because her credits go all the way back to like the... I think she's got a credit going all the way back to like 79 or something. Maybe she was a child... Maybe she was a child actress at that point, I guess. I don't know. Gotta be. Let me think. So, just looking if there's anything else I have here. I feel like I'm... I just want to add a lot more to say about this episode. So good.
Well, there is one thing I'd like to add.
That please
maybe
do.
You'd like to add to, and that is...
Go to it.
We do get also a great moment. We do get a great moment from Christian Slater.
Right.
When he finally appears and walks up from the bookcase, and it's interesting that the way they play it, that Vera for a second isn't sure he's who he is, and then he goes, "Oh yeah, you're him," right. And engages in an entirely different type of dialogue. with him than he has with Elliot before. And that shift and seeing that, and you alluded to it, and then that's when the gun gets pulled because Mr. Robot's clearly not taking any crap and giving it back to Vera. But I like the way that scene played out, and it was nice to see him get a moment because this show, in a lot of ways, I mean, this was sort of like the Travolta in Pulp Fiction. Christian Slater really hadn't done something that was seen as substantial and at least critically acclaimed in a while, and he got a lot of credit in season one, and this put him back on the map.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I was someone who was very outspoken throughout my life of not being a Christian Slater fan because I felt when he was first lifting off and becoming super popular, I felt he was basically doing a poor man's Jack Nicholson impression. That's why while every other person I know is a huge fan of the movie Heathers, I can't stand it because of Christian Slater. Because every time you go, greetings and salutations, I'm like, no, you're doing Jack Nicholson, you know, and you're doing it about as well as I just did. But this was the thing that made me get past that. This was going to make me go, okay, I think it's okay for me to like Christian Slater again. And I'm glad you brought him up because that, ooh, big whiff on my part, talking about these three, and I forgot. What's great about him in this episode is he gets to play the bold, brash, you know, ballsy version of Mr. Robot in those initial scenes with Vera and dealing with Peanuts and whatever. But then as the episode progresses on and as we're getting into the therapy session where it's going, obviously he also takes a turn when he's pleading for her not, you know, he's pleading for it not to. And it's one of those things in the show. It's always like, okay, I realize no one else can see this. this is still a construct of Elliot's mind and he hasn't taken over Elliot at this point. It's always a very weird way to how to phrase the whole Elliot being Mr. Robot and back and forth. And kudos to the show for never doing anything like, look, their bodies morph together. But it's also one of the ways we kind of know what's coming because when he goes like, when I can't protect you anymore, and it was like, oh, wait a minute. Uh-oh. And then, again, on top of all this, once we realize what the revelation is, then you realize just how, well, obviously not just how much Elliot is blocked out, because how weird is it that the identity or construct, well, it's actually both, that his mind has created is the image of his father. It's the image of the father he wanted to have.
Right.
As opposed to what he did. What is it? It reminds me of, I think it's a line from a Nirvana song, you know, I wanted to be a father, but instead I had a dad. You know, I always thought that was interesting. You'd think it would be the reverse. I wanted a dad instead I had a father, but whatever.
Right.
But I think it kind of means something along the same lines. So this was the idealized version, the guy that would be looking out for him, even though he was kind of a prick to him a lot, especially in season one. And you realize, but this was his monster. You know, this, and that's the image of his monster is what he uses as his protector. It's dark, it's twisted, it's really, and it's also fascinating the more I think about it, because you think that would be the last thing he would do.
Right. It's completely unexpected, and the emotional shift in that moment makes it powerful, and then subsequent episodes you see the internal dialogue of sort of the explanation that he gives Elliot, I think, in the next episode. But that's what, when I look back on this episode, that there's something about when you hear the words Mr. Robot changes after this episode, and that's what's remarkable.
Right. And I mean, when this aired for the first time, when people were watching it back on, as you said, November 17th of 2019, was it really that?
Yep.
Gosh, it seems so long ago now. Thank you, COVID. I should say thank you, Obama. I'm just kidding. Anyway, at the point when we watched that episode, we weren't sure if we were going to see, you know, the quote unquote, I keep saying quote unquote, Mr. Robot again.
Right.
Because that the way that revelation plays, like, oh, we're not going to see him again, because now that we know the truth and we know what this, what Mr. Robot at the very least resembles, if not, you know, actually supposed to be his father, which is another thing I always try to wrap my head around a little bit. It's like, okay, whatever, I get it. Why would we see him again? But yeah, they do work that, because there are still six more episodes of the season left after this one. They do certainly work that out. And it gets, we get a few more layers of complication as the season goes on. You know, it's like,
precisely.
It's like, so, and you know, and it becomes, it definitely, it's a show that there's not that many shows once you get out of, once you get off the island of Lost. I can't say there's that many shows that one spends time trying to theorize about. There's a difference between, like say when we talk about a show like Fargo, at least a season like this one specifically, I mean, we might speculate about what might happen with characters, but it doesn't give itself to, like, just weird mind-bending theories, because it's not that kind of a show.
Right.
Lost was certainly that kind of a show. This show was actually another show in that similar vein. Because, you know, it's one of those things, again, I know you rewatched several episodes. If I pulled the numbers all together, I probably watched roughly 14 or 15 episodes, to prepare for the podcast, just to get, you know, something I just couldn't help watching again, whatever. And I started realizing and remembering all the theories that were going on around the show, even as it was getting towards the end. You know, there was a lot of talk about there actually being a third personality in Elliot, and who does that represent? And you start thinking maybe there's things that we've seen and we haven't realized, or maybe another, you know, it starts getting kind of, and it's just getting exponentially crazier and crazier. And these were theories that were out there before the final couple episodes of the season, where I said, hey, guess what? Turned out to be crazy after all.
Right. Right. But the thing that I appreciated about this show, unlike some other shows, is when it went off the rails, what happened actually happened, and you didn't have to question the reality of many of the events. So, like, you know, Angela died, Price died, White Rose died, the machine was stopped. There wasn't a reset at the end that erased everything that had happened.
Right.
Everything that happened had happened.
Right.
We changed.
I'm sorry, go on.
I was just going to say, the only thing that changed was the character, not the world in which the character lived.
Right. And it's interesting, because once you get to it was kind of like a two-parter, because I think they aired the same night. I think it was 2 hours the same night, if not mistaken. When they get to that finale, there is that concern, especially when you're getting through the first half of it. And, you know, spoiler, that's actually in my rewatch, it's actually where I left off before I started recording. I'm right at the end of the first part of the two-parter. So I'm basically trying to reach into my mind and remember the rest of it. And I know you were, like, filling in the blanks for me a little bit before the podcast, but we don't need to get that much into that episode, because that's, you know, don't need to. But for what you were just saying, they start to fake you out a little bit in the first half, because you start getting worried. I was like, wait a minute, please don't pull a thing where we're gonna make the last four seasons like not have happened and it was all whatever. And yes, that is not what turns out to be the case. That they absolutely happen. It just turns out to be a bit more complicated, shall we say? But not so complicated, if memory serves. And if you've watched, obviously, you can correct me or confirm as you see fit. If I recall on why I liked the finale of the show, and I've mentioned before, I think, that, hey, I liked this final season so much that it was my pick for the best thing of 2019. I popped this over. It was between this and Watchmen, and I know everyone was picking Watchmen. And that wasn't, and I wasn't trying to be contrary. I don't play that game. I just made the decision. Both were very difficult things to have pulled off. And there's probably there's probably like 98 reasons to pick Watchmen and 99 reasons for me to pick Mr. Robot. And I just said, I got to go with my gut and I'm picking Mr. Robot. And a lot of it had to do with how it ended, because even if there were a lot of wacky, complicated, et cetera, sort of going on, it worked in a way where it didn't, I didn't have to do, if my, again, I'm the way I'm remembering it, I didn't feel I had to do as much heavy lifting to try to explain things away to people the way I did with, say, the end of Lost.
Right.
Where,
look, no, I think that's right. And I think that's a fair, and what I think Esmail did that was remarkable was he made something very complicated. By the time it was over, you still were confident about what you'd just seen. That when it ended, that the most amazing thing about it, the very last episode, I think, is named High Elliot, mm-hmm. is because the last scene is Darlene saying, "Hi, Elliot," and that's when the real Elliot is emerging, and all of the personalities that have kept him alive during this time are now done and are going off, you know, to wherever they go. And so the real Elliot we never saw. There's some version of him that's probably like the version we see in the first half of the finale, and that's who he is in the real world, but we never see that character in the real world.
Right. I'm just, because I don't, even though I might have had my notes, I could have just scrolled them to see. Yep, you're right. Hello, Elliot is the.
Hello, Elliot. Okay.
Which makes sense.
Something like that.
Which makes sense because there's a lot of things about the show where, you know, they do a lot of full circling with things that, you know, were planted or seen way back in the beginning. And if I'm not mistaken, even though it's done in one of those wacky little computer Cody like things, the first episode, the core of the first episode is "Hello, friend." I mean, it's, you know, it's EPS 1.0_hellofriend.mov. Yeah. Or "Hello, friend."
Right.
Yeah. If I felt like going on, I already read what the, you know, to describe what the titles represent in each of the seasons and what they are. And it's actually something very interesting even about what the title represents for this episode. Because you start trying to decide, you know, if you actually know what proxy authentication really means, and then you start deciding how does that factor into this episode, and who is the proxy? Is Krista the proxy? Is Vera the proxy? You know, I tend to avoid those kind of conversations a little bit just because they just get a little bit kind of gooey and silly, I think. I used to be like that, trust me. Thank you, Lost. You know, oh, you know what they mean by the constant, right? But anyway. So, but yeah, great episode. But as I mentioned way back when we started this, there were clearly a lot of other, or at least several other episodes that were really fantastic that, you know, one might say would have contended for this slot. Because there were at least three or four that got mentioned on those lists and articles I referred to way back when. The first one actually being that very first episode, the one I kind of just called the Hello Friend episode. It's definitely one of the better pilots of any dramatic series. I think it's a stretch to say it would be contender for the best Mr. Robot episode, much less being able to appear on this list. You know, there's very few series that I think you can make the case that the pilot would be the best of the series. One of them would be like Walking Dead, which, as some people might remember, just missed making the countdown. But Mr. Robot, as fine a pilot as it is, would not have been the one. The one that we were talking about, probably much better, stronger contender, I would say, is the sixth episode I called the Brave Traveler episode with the breaking Vera out of prison. Exceptional episode with that, and much like this one, gut-wrenching, you know, gut-wrenching ending, you know, so definitely a memorable one, but still, not the best. And also in that season, I think we talked about this when we were first talking about rewatching the show. You got those back-to-back episodes in the first season. I think it's like the eighth and ninth episode. Let's just call them, I just call them like the family reveal episodes. because they're both excellent, but I think they're more about, you know, just shocking reveals, and that's why they're memorable. Maybe they'd be considered the best if we were talking about, like, you know, what's his name? M. Night Shyamalan, a Ding Dong, whatever. But for someone like Esmail, I think there's just better episodes. But those are things I talk about in the early part of the podcast as far as the revelation about Darlene and Mr. Robot, whatever. I personally, the strongest contenders for me, you got a couple in season three, the fifth and sixth episodes. We can just call them like Runtime Error and Kill Process. Runtime Error, that's the one with probably the most technical virtuosity of any episode. That's the one where the entire episode is filmed as though it's one continuous shot. That's right, the entire episode. Suck it, True Detective and Daredevil. You know, oh boy, you did 6 or 7 minutes. Yeah, so did Orson Welles. You know, 70 years earlier than that. But they did the entire goddamn episode that way. That's a terrific and actually really unsettling episode with all that's going on. And then Kill Process, that's the one where Elliot is literally fighting himself. You know, it takes me back to, I think we talked about this, I can't remember what we were talking about, but I'm pretty sure it was with you, where I was thinking of the movie All of Me with Steve Martin.
Yeah.
And by the way, because Esmail, knowing what I know about him, I guarantee he thought of All of Me. I guarantee it. Because Elliot is really beating the crap out of himself while he's trying to avert this major disaster, only to realize that the true master plan was far worse. That's a tough one to beat. That's a very strong episode too.
It is. And the shame of this show to me is season four seemed to fly under the radar and didn't get the attention you or I thought it deserved, because it was a really strong season, mm-hmm. Especially on the heels of season three, which was a rebound in many ways in form. I think if we look through the show, I would say one of the other things that I appreciate about this show is this is a show other than Christian Slater. Now we take Rami Malek for granted.
Right.
But when this show started, nobody knew who the hell he was.
Yeah. I just knew him as he was the creepy guy in that Pacific miniseries.
Right.
That's the only thing I knew him from. It's like, look, because I remember he was like flipping. I don't know if he was throwing pebbles or putting out cigarettes in like the cracked open skull of a corpse that or something, which was just a memorable image for me. But I was like, okay, I'll probably never see this guy ever again. And yeah, now he's huge. I mean, he's, you know, won an Oscar. He's going to be the big Bond villain in the Bond movie that will eventually be released at some point in our lifetime. And before I start talking about any other episode, just to talk about the show in general, one of the things I really love about this series, it's not just the fact that, well, it's a New York show. And at least a few of the seasons were shot in New York. Some of them, or they did a lot, and then when they went back to LA, where they ended up doing a lot of the interiors, they would still at least do the exteriors in New York. I think they did at least one or two full seasons here, and then they relocated to L.A., if I'm not mistaken. I have a friend who actually worked on the show, and he ended up relocating to L.A. That's how I know that's in L.A. So
let me ask you before you move on.
Yeah.
So when you're watching this, are there places you recognize and that you know them and so when you see them?
I can honestly say when we're dealing with New York City, I recognize practically every place they are, practically everywhere they are. I also recognize a mistake they make on the series, which kind of bugs me. And it's a common thing. I'm sure it happens with other people when they see the place where they live depicted in a movie or a TV show. But you got to realize, unfortunately or unfortunately, New York tends to get used for a lot of movies and TV shows. And any New Yorker, when we watch something, we will pick up on something which is like, no, no, no. And it could be something as silly as, there's no way in Die Hard 3 he could possibly get from Yankee Stadium. That is not possible unless he has a transporter. It just is not possible. this show, it feels like, oh, they were doing so well. And they do, for the most part, they do it really well. There's a problem that does happen in the very first episode. And it's funny because they reuse this train station more than once in the show. When Elliot encounters Mr. Robot again on the subway train, and then they finally get off the train and have their first real conversation. And this is before he takes him to where F Society is in Coney Island, right?
Okay, I'm with you.
Here's the thing. They're on the train and they get off at the station, and the station is the Church Avenue station. Now, anyone who lives in New York, we all know where Church Avenue is. We do. It's just, if you don't, it means you haven't lived here more than like a week or something. I don't know. Or you're one of those transplants and you don't count, so, you know, screw you. But they're having a conversation, and it's, where are we going? It's like, we're going to Brooklyn. You know, we're heading to Brooklyn. We're going to Coney Island. And I'm watching it, and I haven't watched the pilot, the first episode, in years. And I'm like, going, whoa, let me rewind that. Did he say, how do we phrase that? And I went back, and that's what he says. We're going to Brooklyn. I was like, dude, you're already well into Brooklyn. Church Avenue is in Brooklyn. That station is a Brooklyn train station. It's not Manhattan. It's not even remotely Manhattan. There's a few times they play with things with stations, and I see where they are, and it's actually an outer borough. And then all of a sudden, Elliot's, you know, home, and he's clearly lives in downtown Manhattan. I think it's a Lower East Side kind of. Yeah, he lives on the Lower East Side. And I was like, well, okay, I'll let that one go. But that, I was like, dude, you're having him say we're going to Brooklyn. You're already in Brooklyn. I was like, I would have been the writer. It's like, just leave out that line. Just say we're going to Coney Island. That's all you had to say. I don't know if the writer screwed that up or if Slater decided to embellish it and screwed it up, whatever. And then I noticed when I watched some of the other episodes, the Church Avenue station is used a couple other times. And I mean, I didn't want to do a full rewatch of the show. If I ever did, I'm like, how many times did they use the Church Avenue? Because it might be just because it's a good space to use, not for any kind of symbolic thing. Although you could say, well, maybe it means it because it's a church. No, shut up. but it kind of that kind of bug. But yeah, but absolutely, if you're a New Yorker, you're recognizing things all the way, and especially. You know, it's kind of fun because if you're a Brooklyn person, you know, the Coney Island stuff, it clearly is Coney Island, which is kind of neat. It's one of the things that kind of attracted me to check out to watch the show in the first place. But what I to kind of lift off from there, one of the things I like about the show, it's not just the look of the show with the cinematography and the location shooting. I find it fascinating that a show that has, you know, these really kind of intensely crazy out there storylines, the more you think about it, at the same time, always feels very real. The people on screen always feel real to me. They do a great job with the extra casting and the character actors they've brought into the show over the course of four seasons. I very much believe everybody in this universe. It's interesting that it's so fantastical and yet it's very grounded at the same time. It's one of the things I really, again, now having watched 14, 15 episodes of the show, I realized that's one of the things I really liked about the show. It kind of felt, had a certain texture to it. You know, and the closest thing I can liken it to is when you're watching like a really good, like maybe a really good early Scorsese movie, you know, when you're watching like Taxi Driver or Mean Streets, it's like, oh, that feels like New York. Same with this show. Oh, that feels, when it's in New York, it's like, oh, that feels like New York. You know, the Washington Township, which I believe is a fictional location, if I'm not mistaken. That's a different story.
Well, I will say that the thing I about the show in general that I appreciated is it was diversely cast and had a lot of representation of different groups, but it all seemed organic. And you know that there were choices like Joey Badass that was a great side character on the show. I really enjoyed him.
Oh, Leon.
The actor who played White Rose, who's been in quite a few things, you get some compelling backstory, mm-hmm. not to excuse the horrendousness of White Rose, but to get White Rose's backstory, to see some representation there. So I thought the extras casting was excellent. And the only thing that they cast in the whole show that ultimately for me worked, but I wondered what the hell they were doing, is when they cast Craig Robinson.
Was that on season two again then, right?
Yeah, that was the prison mental hospital stuff.
The season I skipped. I deliberately skipped. Gotcha. That's right, I forgot he was on.
An interesting choice to play a role unlike something he usually plays. So, I thought they nailed it with the casting in this show. And as we were talking about earlier, to see this show be this successful, and I don't think it's any stretch to say by the end of season one, this show catapulted and got a lot of heat. To have the show carried by a relative unknown with a washed up actor. And at that point, I mean, Esmail had some credits, but he wasn't exactly the next it guy when he made this, and USA gave him a lot of freedom to do this. And by the end of season one, I mean, this was, you know, this put USA as close to prestige TV as they've ever been.
Well, I mean, it was. And everything you said, you know, dead on. It's an amazing choice that they made, because it was a serious departure for them. And I won't even knock them for they haven't had a series like it, because, well, yeah, you haven't had a series like this one. You know, you don't get series like that very often. Just like those other shows I mentioned, there aren't that many other Twin Peaks or Sopranos. There's Pale Imitations, you know, or even Lost for that matter. How many riffs on Lost have you seen since that ended? Which reminds me, since we're talking about USA, and was it? It might have been Leon's character, actually. Correct me if I'm wrong, if you saw the episode or not. They actually have a little, it reminds me of when there's certain Netflix series who like to reference the fact that they're on Netflix, or make fun of the, you know, whether it be Big Mouth or the, series of events, the unfortunate series of events thing where they make little side references to it. There's a little riff on the USA Network here in one of the episodes. Did you see that episode in your rewatch?
I did not, and I don't remember it.
I think it might be the Leon character. It might be another character. So I apologize, because I'm remembering it. I didn't make a note of which episode it was. It's definitely one of the ones I watched. And he says, like, you know, what you think? Something to the effect of, and I'm going to paraphrase because I don't have the time to type it up and try to find the episode or whatever, where the character says, you know, this is not the USA Network or something like that. You know, your character is not wanted or something like that. Because that was their ad campaign, you know, characters wanted or something like that. And I remember cracking, like, okay, they're a little on the nose there. But I feel like it was Leon, because he's the one who makes a lot of interesting pop culture references, whether it be to books or TV shows. You know, he actually will say, I'll see you in the next episode or something like that.
So right.
He's not touching, it's not fourth wall, but it's just the way he talks. You know, it's kind of like, I'd like to see him meet Abed from Community and have those two,
you know. Have the meta pop culture competition.
Oh, but to have that be the character who comments on the fact that people don't read anymore is just, I just thought that was just a brilliant little touch. Just subvert expectations and, you know, prey upon our own, you know, subconscious opinions on race and whatever. Because you know, most of us would not expect that to be the guy who says that. It's like, yeah, you know why you think that? You racist bastard.
Right. Right. That's why all the little flourishes and touches of characters like that, I thought really added up so much to this. And you know, we haven't even talked about Dom, who's becomes very important. I think of other things in doing the rewatch the last season. I think of the creepy taxidermy assassin.
Janice.
For the Dark Army.
Oh, yeah. Janice is great. She's a great character. If we're going to talk about these characters and ones like that, forget Janice. Bobby Cannavale.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
And again, what I love about Bobby Cannavale's character in this is, I'm a big fan of his. When he's in, you know, I kind of sort of hated Vinyl, but there are certain other shows he's shown up on, and it could be, and it's usually for the extent of an entire season, where, you know, the dude brings the goods, but they're such different characters. There's the character he played in one season of Boardwalk Empire. Great character. There's a lot of things I might not remember about Boardwalk Empire. I always remember that character. I always remember that little scene where he goes, you know, you got a gun. He's got a gun. Everybody's got a gun. By the way, Boardwalk Empire deserves to be rewatched one of these days. Or you can go in a totally different direction with the character he played for at least one or more seasons on Nurse Jackie. And his kid was also on the show, too, which is even more fascinating. His actual son played a character, if I'm not mistaken. Pretty sure I'm right about that. Hope I am. If I'm wrong, apologies. But, again, a very different kind of a character. And then we meet this guy. And you know, when you first meet this guy and the way he speaks, the way he's dressed, it's like, you know, at some point we're going to see this character do something horrible.
Yep. Like,
truly, you know, jaw droppingly horrible. And they give it to us in, the show does very well as final episodes, but I think the third season finale is really exceptional. And that's the one where he takes Dom and her boss at the FBI for a little walk, and he had been the mole, and then he goes totally Jack Torrance on him. And I say that deliberately because, again, Sam Esmail, big fan of Kubrick, where does that axe land? That axe lands exactly where Jack's axe landed in Scatman Crothers. Same exact spot. Axe right, basically right to the chest heart. Boom. Same exact shot. It's like, that's not an accent. Of course he did it that way. But I love that character. When Dom runs into him again late in the fourth season at the Little Hudson News at the airport.
Oh yeah.
The fact he insists on her buying the book.
Yeah. He said, hey, she has to pay for that.
Make sure she paid for that. It's like, wait, you actually bought it? Like, I had to. He signed. It's a moment of levity. It's just really like that. I love that character. And he was nominated on something. I don't think it was the Emmys, but one of those, probably those lesser award shows or something. I don't know for that part. Another great character. Speaking of the fourth season, just because I would be remiss if I didn't mention a couple other things. I hinted at it before. As far as contenders for really one of the best episodes of this series, the fifth episode, again, it's the one that starts at the very top of Darlene saying to Elliot, it's cool, dude, we don't have to talk, and then there's no dialogue for the entire episode until you get to the very end when Vera pops up at the very end, and he says, it's time we talked. Of course, it's cute that they do that. I mean, that one, that's on the Mount Rushmore of Mr. Robot episodes. I mean, they get away with cheating because it's the day and age of texting. So a lot of information we get through text between different characters. But I was like, all right, that's fair. That's the nature of the show anyway. A lot of what we watch on the show is on screens, be it computer screens or smartphone screens or whatever. But that's a really great one. And, you know, there's a couple of things, like, once we get past proxy authentication, you know, the 409 conflict, that's the one where they take down the Deus Group once and for all. And I got a little confused about that because everyone's broke at the end of it, including Zhang, right? Because when he freaks out, that's when he takes the gun and he shoots Price himself, whatever. But he's broke. I'm confused. If he's broke at the end of the episode, how is he still in charge? How is the Dark Army still okay and up and running and he's in charge or whatever? Who's paying these guys? Are they just sticking with them regardless of the fact that there's no money? I was a little confused by that the more I thought about it.
That's a good question.
Yeah, but, you know, I let it go. And now let me get to something I hinted at earlier. Okay, I want to ask you a question. And this might have I've been thinking about this. I only watched it a few hours ago. I don't know how many hours ago. I watched it earlier today. It's the episode. We had that one episode which was mostly Darlene and Dom leaving. And then we go back. The next episode, we pick up again in the parking lot with her and Elliot now saying goodbye to each other. And we realize, oh, now we're going to be following Elliot from this point on. I love that conceit. But as she walks away from Elliot, and Elliot's like standing there like in the middle of the parking lot, and she has walked a good, I would say, 20, 30, whatever, feet away from him. And she says something to Mr. Robot, who's leaning against a car. She says something to the effect of, you know, I actually started to like you when you weren't being such a dickhead or something like that. And they kind of laughed. And I went, whoa, wait, what? Are they just being cute here? I think they're just being cute here because she can't actually see him. But she's
good. No, she's being cute. And I'll tell you why. She in the very last episode when the Elliot alter ego wakes up in the hospital by in the real world before relinquishing control to the real Elliot, and he's talking to Darlene about it all and realizing that he has to let go if the real Elliot's going to come back. There's some conversation to the. It basically goes to the point of that she knew when he wasn't him. She knew when Mr. Robot was there. She knew when other people were there. She knew it when it wasn't him. Mm-hmm. So she recognized the difference in them. So I think they were just being cute. But I have to say, Carly Chaykin, I mean, or I don't know how, if that's how you say it. That's how I would pronounce it based on how it's spelled. But,
I would pronounce it too.
You know, another, for me, a vastly overlooked performance in this show. She was just outstanding.
Oh yeah, I mean, it's almost if there was any shame about talking about proxy authentication required, it's just she's not in that episode. But when you get that episode, which comes just a couple later, speaking of Dom and Janice, the one where Dom is lying on the floor with the knife in her chest. And Janice is threatening to kill Dom's family and that whole stuff. Oh, the work that she does is fantastic. All the way up to when you get to the later episode with the airport scene when she's hyperventilating in the airport bathroom. And they do that. I love how Esmail first goes like, okay, you want the cliche? I'm going to give you the cliche. She's changed her mind and she's going to run for the airplane. Yeah, I'm not so big on that cliche. I'm going to make a little twist here. Hey, but guess what? But now she got off it. So now they reverse positions. And now Dom's going to Budapest, which is great. It's so funny watching, again, talking about knowing New York, recognizing locations. It's like where I used to, when my office relocated for a few years to this another location, which was not far from, I'll use like a major thing that you would be familiar with, the Lincoln Tunnel over there or the Holland Tunnel? I think it's the Holland Tunnel. Holland Tunnel. My office was near where the entrance to the Holland Tunnel is in New York City. And it's kind of a very remote part of New York where you know, it's a very industrial, but it's very up and coming, whatever. It's expensive, of course, whatever. It's nice. Very close to the water. But then one of the issues of working over there is like, oh, trying to find somebody's, you know, food. And you have to walk, you know, these big long blocks to get to where all the food places were, nice, but whatever. And one of the places that people would get food from all the time, you know, you walk down a block and over like two blocks, was Lupe's. It's a little restaurant, little Mexican, Spanish-Mexican restaurant over there, which is where they filmed the scene where the whole big shootout happens, and they kill what's his name? Her Darlene's boyfriend at the time, Cisco, gets killed there.
Yeah.
And I remember watching for the first time because I recognized like the little neon sign. I was like, oh my god, they shot at Lupe's? I didn't know they shot at Lupe's. That's awesome. I was like, oh shit. They shot up Lupe's? I didn't know they shot up Lupe's. I was just there. When did they shoot that? I didn't go on vacation. They shoot it at night. Actually, they probably did shoot it at night, actually. Anyway. So, yeah, it's a damn good episode and a damn good show. And that's why it made number 17 on the countdown. Is there any... Now, we've got a little bit of time here. Is there anything else that comes to mind you wanted to mention before I get to anything else here?
No, I just wanted to ask you one last question.
Go for it.
Anything that you feel like you could share that your friend communicated about his experience while working on the show?
I have to be honest. I don't want to make more of our friendship than it actually is, because I've hardly spoken to him much in the last few years. It was just, you know, we were friends at work and we hung out and drank and all the time. I didn't talk to him too much once he kind of relocated for most of the time in L.A. So I can't recall much of anything. I know he was good friends with someone, I think another writer on the show or someone else on the show, and that's how he met Esmail, and they became friends. And he ended up working on his the show he did for Amazon, maybe, was it
Homecoming with Julia Roberts?
Yeah, he worked on that show as well. But it's one of those things that if I felt more comfortable, I actually would have contacted him myself. As opposed to asking someone else to contact him, stupid way to phrase it. I would have contacted him and asked him to even show up on the podcast, but I think he'll just be annoyed with it, so I didn't want to bother him. So I have a friend who works at AMC, and I've thought about asking him if he would come up on the podcast so we could talk about stuff like Breaking Bad and Mad Men and whatever. But part of me is like, do I know him well enough to ask him to do that? I know him, we drink occasionally together, but I don't know, so I don't do it.
Right, I got you.
Yeah. I'm shy. So
so shy.
So shy. All right. So now that we're done talking about number 17 on the greatest TV drama episodes of all time countdown, we can take a quick look back. So far we've had number 20, which was House's Head from House, number 19, which was The Getaway from Dexter. Number 18 was Out of Gas from, not me apparently, no, Firefly. Trust me, this microphone's sensitive. You'd hear it, people. And now we just talked about, you know, number 17, which clearly was, you know, 407 proxy authentication required from Mr. Robot. So now, folks out there, you might be wondering, hey, so... Where's the sound on my phone? What's number 16 on the greatest TV drama episodes of all time, Scott? Well, coming in at number 16 is the second season finale of the so dearly departed Hannibal. The episode that was titled Mizumono, or Mizumono, or Mizumono. I don't know how to pronounce it. I'm going to say it's the second season finale of Hannibal. Now, what's conceivably more exciting, at least a couple listeners, not me personally, but you know, joining me for that feast of fun that episode is sure to be, oh my God, none other than the missing in action Viking Prince, STVD co-host making his return to the podcast after I don't know how long. Dark. We talked about Dark. That's what it was. Dan. Dan is returning to the podcast to talk about Hannibal. Yay.
Yay, Dan.
No, I get it. He's already, when he last texted me, I think he's already completed his damn rewatch of the whole show. So it's like he's been in training. We'll see how it comes out. Now, for folks out there who remember our Hannibal podcast, which I can't explain it, is actually still our most popular run of podcasts we've ever had on this in the entire 284 episodes. The three of the four Hannibal episodes are the most downloaded, most listened to ever. I don't know why, but it just worked out that way. There might be a reason why, and it's possible that someone else might also be back for that podcast. I'm not going to say who, but if you're a listener who enjoyed our coverage of that final season of Hannibal, you might be able to guess who or what I'm talking about. And if you don't, shame on you. And you might be in for a treat. We'll see. That person might be showing up. It really depends how much alcohol might be consumed previous to podcast. We shall see.
What was Andy Kaufman's manager's name? Tony.
Not Tony Roma. Tony, that's a football player.
that shows up mysteriously and demands his own dressing room.
The guy would sing Volare all the time. Volare, Cantare. Yeah, I love that guy. Excellent. Yes. Well, you know, it's funny because we just spent the entire podcast talking about a character with a dissociative identity disorder. Maybe in the Hannibal podcast, we might discover one of the hosts of the show perhaps has a dissociative identity disorder.
Well, you know, we've covered that. We've covered a serial killer, there you go. You'll have you've done Dexter and now we've done Elliot. So it's it's all in line and all the stars are lining up.
Oh, yeah. Hopefully if things work out, Dan will be returning for certainly a few more of these that are right up Dan's alley. But we can't get there from here, as Michael Stipe once said. We got to finish up this podcast first. So if you enjoyed, wow, that was just, I just came up with that. I'm a genius. If you enjoyed this podcast, guess what? You'll enjoy hanging out on our Facebook page as well. Track us down on Facebook. We're the Serious TV Drama Podcast. Type that in, like the page, and you can like us and talk about shows like this one and so many others, you know, Fargo's and whatever else. You can also find us on Apple Podcasts. You can subscribe to our feed there as well as rate and review us. You can now find us on Stitcher. I did not write down the actual location to find us on Stitcher, so bad on me, but I have it right here. Go to Manage Show. Go to Bad Podcaster. Oh, go to Stitcher.com/podcast/the-serious-tv-drama-podcast. Still, no one's downloaded anything from that. I'm glad it didn't cost me any money for a change, because I would really be really pissed off. Anyway, you can always just go to our host page, you know, stvdpodcast.podbean.com, and you can go to the archive of all 284 of our podcasts there. And finally, you can follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @stvdpodcast. That's STVD as in serious TV drama. So Brian and I will be back a few days after we release this one, talking about the next episode of Fargo, of course. Brian is also, I would bet even money Brian's going to be back for at least one or two more, maybe more, we'll see, of these countdown episodes. I think we've already discussed one. Oh, yes, we did. You're definitely going to be back for one, but we're a ways away from that one, so you might be back sooner than that one. See, I didn't give it away to the listeners. See, good. Now I'm being a good podcaster. So, Brian, thank you for your patience in dealing with me, because I know how much of a handful I could be on these podcasts. But thank you so much for agreeing to do this and loading up on the Mr. Robot episodes. And I look forward to our next go around. And hope everybody out there enjoyed it. Good night to you. Good night to everybody else. And I will let you have the last word. Just dragging it out. Oh, look at this. Again, hour and a half. Perfect podcasting timing. Okay, go for it.
Well, I hope everyone has a good night, and I'll end to play off what Scott said earlier. When the world is a monster, bad to swallow you whole, kick the clay that holds the teeth in, throw your trolls out the door. That's a little REM to end the night. Good night, everybody. Have a great week, and we'll see you Sunday.